For the week of April 30th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 364, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the Bahamas, trying to get home, I'm Michael Giltz.
Whoa, you must have been at the Fyre Festival.
Why did this debacle gain so much media attention?
It was like
a nothing festival with nobody in it. Why is it all anybody can talk about?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One, social media made a big deal out of it. Now, whether it deserved to have a big deal made out of it on social media is another story. I'd agree with you. I also think that there are so many festivals these days. I mean, Live Nation owns 45 festivals. Live Nation, okay? How is there time in the year to attend 45 festivals?
Well, I'm pretty sure the idea is that most people just go to one or two.
Correct. So here's one that's being put on by, you know, a group of people, Ja Rule, the rapper Ja Rule.
Oh, let's not go into it. Everybody knows about it. It was a debacle. It was ridiculous. And who cares?
Well, what we should explain, it was a festival in the Bahamas. Things happened. They could not accommodate not only the talent, but the attendees. Let's just leave it at that. But what kills me is seeing that a 25-year-old guy, Billy McFarlane, tried to put this on, and he's like, yeah, I guess we just were too naive. Yes, you're too naive. You're 25 years old. When I first started going to Coachella, you were 10 years old. So if you
I don't think his age is germane.
Well, it would shock me if he was experienced enough to pull this off on an island of all places.
Well, he didn't partner with the right people. They said, we picked an island where, oh, there's no infrastructure, no water and sewage. It was very challenging. Well, why'd you pick that island, I wonder? It's like, there's no way to get people on or off, and there's no toilets. Seems like a bad choice. But anyway, I just thought it was ridiculous how much attention it got. Rolling Stone let him post a whole, like, PR press release on their website saying, oh, we feel really bad. It's like, why? If you got an interview with him and wanted to interview him, you should have grilled him on being a moron, and that would be it. He said, well, we launched this idea and it took on a life of its own. No, it didn't. You proposed a festival, people gave you money, and then you couldn't do it. That's not a life of its own. A life of its own is something that gets to, oh, what's happening here? No, you said, I want to have a festival, people gave you money, and then you blew it. I don't know. It was bizarre from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Much like seeing Chris Dodd not show up at CinemaCon, and now we know why.
Yes, well, apparently the fears that, well, is Chris Dodd on his way out? I mean, his contract runs until 2018 over at the Motion Picture Association of America. Would he be, you know, he's not showing up to CinemaCon, and he says there's a scheduling conflict, even though CinemaCon is planned years in advance. So we're not quite sure why there would be a scheduling conflict at CinemaCon. NATO and the head of NATO, John Fitton.
We know he's out. He's fired. He's gone. He's quit. He's been fired. We know. We all know this. We've heard it all.
Right. Well, but
we don't need to reboot the whole thing. Yes, he didn't show, and now he's fired, and that's why he didn't show. And we should have said it at the time. But you thought, well, maybe there's something awkward and personal they don't want to discuss, and they're just trying to be discreet. But the fact is, it was, you know, obvious. It should have been. Hey, he's not here. He's on his way out.
Yeah, despite what anybody might say. Now, I got a little background on this from some folks in the industry. I'm working on a piece for Celluloid Junkie. And here's the deal. So, you know, with Hillary Clinton running for president, Senator Dodd, thought, hey, I'm going to be able to, you know, get a job with the administration. And he was shooting for an ambassadorship to Ireland, which was pretty much locked up, apparently. As you know, things didn't turn out the way anybody expected, and Hillary Clinton didn't win. He didn't get his ambassadorship. His mind was—he was already halfway out the door in his mind.
Well, he was not having a good tenure either. I mean, the point is, he wanted to switch because it wasn't a happy mix. It's not the fact that he didn't get the ambassadorship to Ireland. He was looking for another job because he wasn't happy, and they weren't happy with him.
Well, and I think he kind of went, wow, this is really difficult. Six studios, all of whom have different interests and different agendas, and they're all yelling and fighting and squabbling with one another. And I can't even make a statement about a studio being hacked here without all six of you agreeing on what that statement is. And since you're all chicken, that you think that North Korea is going to come after you if a statement is made, then, you know, I can't win.
So you're putting the onus on them, not him.
I think it's both, but I think it's a tough job. That has become a much tougher job over time.
Well, it's different now. It used to be they were on the same page on the major issues, and now the major studios are not on the same page, looking at, for example, shortening windows.
Correct.
When you talk about how quickly should a movie go from theater to home, every single studio has a different position. That makes it hard to be the representative of them, I guess. But nonetheless, not a happy mix. He wasn't doing well. He wanted out. His way out fell apart. Nonetheless, they're like, oh, you want to leave? You can leave.
Right.
And now Charles Rivkin is coming in. No, right.
Yes, Charles Rivkin, who worked for the State Department. He used to work in Hollywood. He was the head of the Henson Company. He went to work for government, where he wound up as the ambassador to France, I think. And then wound up...
With these people in ambassadorships? I want an ambassadorship.
It's a really good job, apparently. Apparently, we're in the wrong business. But he's coming back to Hollywood after a stint in the State Department. I think he was the undersecretary, you know, deputies. I don't know. One of those secretaries over at the State Department. And a number of executives in town told me was they were really impressed with how quiet they kept the executive search for this, that nobody knew that, you know, there was some speculation because of the whole CinemaCon thing that Dodd may be on his way out, but there was no there was no talk about, you know, interviews for replacing him, which you'd normally hear.
And of course, he's going into the job. What's the first thing he's going to do day one?
China, China, China.
No, he's going to listen to Showbiz Sandbox.
Oh, well, that he's already doing that. He's got a prep for the job. So he's, you know, he's listening to us. Of course.
And when he's doing that, what will he hear about this week?
Well, on this week, you know, I wish we had Wolf Blitzer because it's all breaking news. First, we're going to celebrate another year of growth in music sales globally, not just in North America, not just in Europe. And yes, you can thank streaming for that growth. We'll also cover the Tony Award nominations and save you the bother of watching the show by getting Michael. You're going to tell us who's going to win. You're like a fortune teller.
Absolutely.
And by the way, that happened literally minutes ago. That's how, you know, I wish we had Wolf Blitzer to do his breaking news thing. On Inside Baseball, we'll fill you in on even more breaking news, the latest news about the looming writer strike. Oh wait. Actually, this just in. That huge sigh of relief that you hear behind me, Michael, is coming from Southern California, means that there won't be a strike after all. We'll explain why. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And usually we look at box office around the world. But today we're going to start with North America. Everybody's talking about global box office now, and that's a great thing. It's fascinating to see it get more and more attention in the mainstream media. But here, the big news is the global box office at North America. The number one movie in North America is The Fate of the Furious, another $19 million. But the number two and the number three films are really astonishing, and it's not just because it's a slow week. They have good grosses. The number two movie in North America is How to Be a Latin Lover, which grossed $12 million in that market. And number three is Bahubali 2, The Conclusion, which grossed $10 million in North America alone on just 425 screens. So you have a film from India and a film that appeals to Central and South America, to the Latino Hispanic audience, both of them ranking number two and number three over the weekend's box office. That's just mind-blowing. And it's not because like nobody went to any movies and some movie with $4 million snuck into the top 10. This is the number two and the number three movie in North America. And when that happens, people see those names and they go, hey, maybe I should check out this movie, Bahubali 2. Or, hey, maybe I should go see How to Be a Latin Lover. And that's how you gain more and more traction and audiences. So to me, it's just a mind-blowing change in what's happening in North American box office.
You know, the clips that they showed of How to Be a Latin Lover at CinemaCon were hilarious.
And those were in English. It's in both English and Spanish versions, I believe.
No. Well, it's mostly in English because...
It's also available in a pure Spanish version. Sure the clips they showed you were, but the film is shown in both Spanish and also English versions.
Okay. I didn't realize they had done that. And by the way, that $12 million came from 1,118 theaters.
Right. And this is a movie starring Eugenio Derbez. He did the movie Instructions Not Included, which was a heartwarming little family film. And now he stars in this broad comedy. That movie he like wrote, directed, and starred in. This one, he's the hired gun. And he stars as a sort of a gigolo boy toy with a much older woman. And they're together for like 25 years. And then suddenly she's 80 and she dumps him for a younger model. And now as a middle-aged, you know, Lothario, he has to sort of make his way in the world again. He has to move back in with his sister. And there's some big names like Salma Hayek and Rob Lowe and Kristen Bell all in the movie. So it's probably a bigger budget, I'm sure, than Instructions Not Included. But it's a really great start for this movie. He's a big star. And again, the number two movie in North America and the number three is an Indian film. That is just mind-blowing to me.
Well, you know, Selma Hayek and Yuheni, I can't pronounce it the way she did, but she kept saying the big joke at CinemaCon when they were on stage together was how to pronounce his name and how she felt like,
Eugenio Derbez.
She's like, it's like I have something caught in my throat. She just, it was funny. I guess you had to be there.
Yes, and Bahubali 2, the conclusion, is part two of an epic fantasy. It's not in the Hindi language, so it's not a Bollywood film. It's from like the southern region of India. I hope I'm getting that correct. It's big, splashy first film. This is the sequel. Made a ton of money worldwide. We'll get to that. A lot of screens in India upgraded to 4K just in anticipation of this movie. Sort of like the Avatar effect, where people are like, oh, we got to get 3D. We got to get ready for this movie Avatar. In this case, they wanted to get movie and upgrade to 4K so they could show this film in the best way possible. It made $1.8 million from IMAX in North America, which is a North American record for a foreign language film. It's just a major, major step in every possible way. Well, so I feel like that just really changes the landscape. But to me, it's like when the Billboard magazine switched how they tracked album sales. And they went to real album sales rather than estimates. And suddenly you had country albums and gospel albums and rap albums in the top 10. And that made people say, hey, maybe I should try Garth Brooks out. And seeing them in the top five of North America, that really has to wake people up because people pay a lot of attention to what the number two and number three movies are in the country.
That's true. Now, just a little tease for something that's going to come up later in the program. We're going to be talking about the 3D effect, but not in North America.
All right. That's right. It's still big around the world. So now let's switch to the worldwide box office. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes, though they do get called out by one of the trade papers this week in their reporting. We also pull information from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, you name it. And now looking at the worldwide box office, the number one movie around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Mediocre reviews, people don't think it's as good as the original, but audiences are flocking. $101 million worldwide. It opens up in New York this Thursday. And a New York in America this Thursday. New York is America. So it's looking great.
You can direct your emails to Michael Giltz.
It's tracking well in terms of how the first movie did. So clearly they got a big audience with the first one, and now they're going to build on it with the second one. So it looks like it's going to be in the billion-dollar club. This movie is just tracking really, really well. That's a crazy thing to say. There's only been 30-plus movies in history that have grossed $1 billion, but this is going to join the club.
Well, and Jim Amos over at my stomping ground, Celluloid Junkie, another plug, he says he's got it tracking to about $160 million for its opening weekend.
In North America.
In North America, sorry, yes.
Right. All right. So at number two around the world is The Fate of the Furious, $87 million worldwide. And now it's past the $1 billion mark. It's at $1,060 million. At number three is The Boss Baby, the animated film. That grossed $24 million. And that's at just under $400 million worldwide. But wait. That's what the report was from ComScore, that the number two movie was $87 million, Fate of the Furious, and number three was The Boss Baby at $25 million, $24 million. But in fact, according to, is it Variety or The Hollywood Reporter? It was according to Variety. They call out Bahubali 2 as having made a lot more money, and it didn't make sense to me. We were showing that it had grossed $10 million in North America, but only $3 million in the rest of the world. I thought, did they open it up here first? I didn't know what was going on. But Variety says they're missing the Indian box office, that they say when you look at the producer statements and local box office reports, that in fact, Bahubali did not make $13 million worldwide this weekend as ComScore reported, but in fact they made, where is it? They made $81 million worldwide. So that makes a lot more sense. It explains that $10 million in North America was matched by $71 million in the rest of the world. It's playing in seven territories, so it really must have torn it up in India. So the number three movie around the world, according to Variety, is in fact Bahubali 2 at $81 million. So Guardians of the Galaxy at $100 million, Fate of the Furious at $87 million. According to Variety, then it's Bahubali 2 at $81 million. And then down below that, at number four, is The Boss Baby at $24 million. And again, I think this is exciting. The more people that pay attention to worldwide box office, the more they can cross-check each other, keep each other honest, because sometimes we've had some questions or confusions. It's really hard to track the worldwide box office and get reports from every country in the world. It's not easy. You're sort of dependent on what the studios tell you. And sometimes in India or other territories like Korea, they're not in the loop as much, or they're not concerned with you. But now this movie is a big worldwide player, and it's good and important for them to make sure they're as high up in the box office chart as they can be. So I think that reporting is just going to get better and better. At number four is Shockwave.
Actually, this would be number five because...
I'm going to have to make changes every single... Up next, forget the number, is Shockwave, another $24 million, just below Boss Baby. This is a Chinese Hong Kong thriller starring Andy Lau as an undercover bomb disposal expert. So that's a good start. And number six is Beauty and the Beast, another $23 million, $1.1 billion worldwide. This movie is now moving into like the top 15, top 10 of all-time grossing movies. And remember, this is kind of a roll of the dice. A live-action version of their beloved animated film. It could have just been a turkey. It could have been whatever. To say it's a success is just it's an understatement.
Well, it's a little bit less of a roll of the dice after The Jungle Book. They were able to do that, and it worked. They had the
Maleficent and all that, but they've had a number of successes of turning animation into live action. It's right. True. But, you know, Jungle Book does not have the same beloved pull. You're not messing with the most iconic film of the last 30, 40 years from Disney.
True.
You know, I feel like it was a much bigger risk because you also don't want to tarnish the original. At number seven is Battle of Memories, a Chinese sci-fi thriller that grossed $22 million over the weekend. At number eight is Smurfs The Lost Village, $15 million over the weekend, $155 million. So it's just getting close to tripling its $60 million budget. So another success story. So perhaps there will be another Smurfs film. And then there is number nine. Finally, we're back on track because of Bahubali's position on the chart. And number nine is Love Off the Cuff, a Hong Kong Chinese rom-com. It grossed $13 million on its opening weekend. I guess it opened on a Thursday because its total is $14 million. It's the third in a series. Love in a Puff, Love in the Buff, which sounds the most exciting to me, and now Love Off the Cuff. So I don't know what the next one will be, but I'm sure it'll rhyme.
Love in some stuff? Hey, I'm pretty good at this.
There you go. And number 10 is This Is Not What I Expected, another Chinese romantic comedy. Is it like Chinese romantic, you know, Valentine's Day or something over there? $12 million over the weekend, $16 million total. So that has made more money since it opened, probably on a Wednesday or a Thursday, than the movie just above it. It's about a female chef at a Western-style hotel who has a relationship with her boss, and then he fires her, he loses his job, and she gets fired, or they break up, and then she gets fired, and then she gets another job, and she falls in love with that boss as well. So not exactly wild on the empowerment scale, but I bet she's a great chef. At number 11 is How to Be a Latin Lover, $12 million over the weekend. At number 12 is The Circle. This opened up in North America, is that it?
Yes, North America. This is an STX film starring Tom Hanks and Emma Watson.
Emma Watson, who has the massive hit of Beauty and the Beast. So she's used to being in movies that are both beloved and hugely profitable, thanks to that and Harry Potter. And now we have The Circle, which may be the most hated movie of the year.
So far.
I mean, the reviews were brutal. One of our regular listeners texted me and was like, gave me his review. I'm like, why did you go see The Circle? Like, everybody knew it was horrible. I chided him unnecessarily, cruelly. On going on a rare date movie with his wife to The Circle. He's like, well, you know, he liked the book, he likes Tom Hanks, blah, blah, blah. Oh, well. So this movie really, I mean, a D-plus cinema score, which you have to really work hard to get something. You have to spit in the face of the audience as they leave the theater in order to get a score that low. So that is a movie that I am not interested in checking out. Scrolling down at the list of any other new movies, we've got a few. We've got The Mayor, which is a South Korean political drama. It made $5 million on its opening weekend. And we have The King's Case Note, which is a South Korean period comedy sort of mystery in which the king and one of his acolytes work together to solve a mystery. That made $4 million in its opening weekend. So a lot of excitement all over the world. Very excited in the North American box office to see those two movies in the top three. That really is a sea change of what can happen and what it means, you know, for the box office down the road. I mean, it really, people pay more attention to worldwide box office, and now they're paying more attention to movies where it really matters by going to see them in the theater here in North America.
Speaking of movies that really matter, or mattered back in 2009, remember Avatar? And last week we talked about Avatar and how it was going to like make a movie a year for like the next 25 years. Remember how we talked about that?
I do.
Well, according to numerous sources, it looks like all the other studios said, well, if you're going to date your movies, we're going to date our movies. Star Wars Episode 9 is opening May 24th, 2019, not at Christmas during the holidays when the last couple of movies had been released.
Yeah, I wonder why they did that switch. They sort of had a holiday tradition, but now they said they want to go back to where most of the Star Wars movies open, which was in summer, see how it does there. But they're starting at first with the Han Solo movie, the young Han Solo movie, which opens in May of 2018. So next summer, not this summer, but next summer, we'll have the Han Solo movie. So we'll have to see how that works. Maybe they'll change their mind and push it back, but I doubt it. I'm sure it'll do well wherever they open. Yeah, so The Lion King live action got a release date in 2019 in the summer. Frozen 2 has a release date in November of 2019. And Avatar has started saying, all right, we're going to have two movies for the next 4 years starting in 2020. 2020, 21, then a jump to 2024 and 2025. So, you know, James Cameron knows what he's going to do for the next 1,000 years. What I liked was that they said they're moving the Indiana Jones movie to July of 2020 to make room for The Lion King. Harrison Ford is going to be 78 years old in July of 2020. I mean, dear God.
Wow. The fact that he's 78 makes me feel old. But
he will be in 2020.
Well, all of those movies, they're big movies, as we talked about. They're all going to play in China, more than likely.
Oh, absolutely. And we've been talking about release dates. The ones we pay attention to are when movies get a release date in China. Their old quota was 34 international films. They would allow 34 movies from around the world play in China. That's clearly fallen by the wayside. This year, they're already at 24 movies with a release already been released or with a release date coming soon, you know, like the summer movies like Wonder Woman and Transformers. Every time we get one of those, we mark it up. So they're at 24 so far, and that's really helped the box office, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, in the first quarter of this year, box office in China grew 10% over 2016.
And of course, they had like 50%, 80% growth at a certain period, but then they hit a wall last year and they didn't want that to happen again. So now they're back on the upward slide again by bringing in more Hollywood movies.
Yes, Hollywood says
their own movies are doing great too, of course, but you know, they need more product.
Yes, and I believe you wrote here, Hollywood says, you're welcome.
That's right. Right. And the same thing might be said of streaming companies, which says you're welcome to the music industry. They devastated the music industry because suddenly people could get music. They didn't have to buy it anymore. But now finally, they're starting to see enough people buy subscriber streaming services that they're starting to get an uptick in music sales again, aren't they?
Yeah. So there was a 15-year decline, as we all know. Global recorded music lost about 40% of its market value. And now, as you mentioned, Michael, the music industry is kind of perking back up thanks to streaming. And for the second year in a row, music sales worldwide, not just in North America or Europe, which we've talked about previously this year. So all of what we're talking about includes streaming and physical product and digital. All of that income grew 6% to $15.7 billion.
Right. So the global music sales, it doesn't include concerts and a lot of other stuff or merchandise beyond actual music sales. But if you're subscribing to a music service or you're buying an LP or CD or you're buying a digital album or single, then that's part of this number, which is $15.7 billion worldwide. Still significantly down from where it was, but at least it's moving in the right direction. How many people are we talking about?
Well, 112 million people pay for some sort of access to streaming. So that's pretty good. And that's around the world. Another 100 million access streaming, of course, via these free tiers where you listen to some of the ads or, you know, they pay for it in other ways.
Right. And so when you look at the global music sales, $15 billion, exactly half of that is digital. Half of that income comes from digital. Streaming income was up 60%. Which means people are not buying as much digital. Of course, that's down 20%. Physical is down 7%. You know, people, oh, vinyl is back, blah, blah, blah. But people are not buying physical product or even digital product. More and more money is coming strictly from streaming. So instead of buying 3 or 4 or 5 albums a year, they're getting you to fork over $8 or $10 a month. And they'll be happy with that as long as another 100 million people sign up for the service.
Well, here's an interesting figure then. You know, we're talking about all these millions and millions of people and the billions of dollars. So 212 million people, $4 billion is what they generate on streaming platforms. However, and here's the interesting fact, YouTube, 900 million people access music on YouTube, but they only generate $553 million.
So it's 200 million people generating $4 billion, or almost a billion people, 900 million people only generating $500 million. So the people on streaming services are generating eight times as much money, despite being, you know, a quarter of the size. There's a lot more people who access movie on YouTube, and they're making a lot less money from it at the studios, at the record labels. And that's why they yell and scream at YouTube all the time and feel like they're not paying their fair share.
Well, and I wonder whether recording artists would say, yes, we understand that we're kind of, you know, not making as much money as we could be on YouTube. However, it's good enough that it serves as a wonderful promotional tool for when we go on tour. Everybody knows our music because they're either listening to it on Spotify or Apple Music or any one of the streaming services, and or they're listening to it and finding it on YouTube.
Well, they would say no. The artists are very angry with you. They don't think they're getting enough money from YouTube. They're generating tons of listenership and stuff, and they're paying out tenths of a penny, and it's not enough to them. They're saying, we're not getting our fair share. It's great entertainment. People love it. They're willing to pay for it. You're just not charging enough.
Well, let me ask you this then, because I was a little shocked. And every time I see this, I kind of go, I wonder why they're doing that, which is I was on YouTube earlier today, and there's a singer-songwriter named LP. She writes music for a lot of like the Rihannas of the world, and she now has her own act. And I saw that, you know, she had a song posted from her own account, audio only. So it was just a picture of her,
right,
and the song. And I thought, why would she post this on YouTube, which it's going to be streamed for free, and maybe she'll make some money through the record company, you know, through the ad chat, who knows. But why would she do that if it wasn't helping her in some way, shape, or form?
Well, it does help you, and to say you want to be your music on the radio, and you want your music to be available on YouTube for people to play, but you just want to get more money for it. That doesn't mean you say, well, I'll just cut my nose off to spite my face and never have a song on the radio. You know, that's not a logical response. So she's just saying, yeah, I want to be on YouTube. I want people to hear my single, so maybe they'll buy the album, or they'll go to a service where they can stream the whole album legally. Maybe they'll see me on tour, but I still would like more money. I'd like a higher royalty than what I'm getting right now.
Well, we've said here and you know, numerous times throughout the years that once streaming got to, you know, mass scale, and by the way, we've said it because record executives told us, look, you get to 50 million users and now we're talking, now we're replacing CD revenue.
But that's 50 million North America, right?
Correct. Yes. But now we're talking 212 million worldwide, so you're seeing, you know, that we were correct. You have enough people paying $9, $10, $12 per month, and it generates money.
Right. There's only 100 million paying the fees, though.
Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah. You know. So if they got 200, if they doubled the number of people paying for a monthly service, yeah, that would be a big change. And I wonder how many albums up for Best Musical of the Year are available on those streaming services. I assume they're out there.
Well, I know Hamilton was. You know, but that's last year's. Now, speaking of changes, by the way, we should point out that we're skipping over our book filter segment this week because the Tony Award nominations were announced just an hour or two ago. And Michael, why don't you walk us through this? It looks like there are 13 new musicals, the most in 36 years. What happened?
Well, yeah, it was a big season, a ton of new musicals, a ton of new plays. And of course, that meant some people got shut out. There's only four shows, maybe five, depending on the voting, that can be nominated for Best Musical or Best Supporting or Best, you know, Revival or Best Play. And that means a lot of shows got hurt, but there's a lot of attention.
We got hurt by it. Showbiz Sandbox, the musical, was not nominated. We can, you know, spoiler alert.
So unfair. That's right. So the big winner was The Great Comet, the musical version of War and Peace. That got the most nominations. That's probably only because Hello, Dolly, the big revival, wasn't eligible for a lot of awards because it's a revival. So it's not up for score or book or some of the other things. But that is probably the biggest show of the season so far. They won't be competing. Great Comet's up for Best Musical. Hello, Dolly is up for Best Revival of a Musical. And then the Best Play was a very exciting thing because there were four plays, all by Americans, and all making their Broadway debut, nominated for Best Play. So that's a really big sea change. And of course, when you're looking at the shows, you want to see, well, who got the most nominations, and that can tell you who the favorites are for the Tony Award people. It's a really exciting year. I mean, you know, a lot of times on Broadway, you barely get four plays that are worth promoting. You have one that's so clearly better. You know who's going to win. There is very little that's clear here. One thing is clear. Hello, Dolly for Best Revival and Bette Midler for Best Actress. All the other lead actresses who were nominated can say, "Woo! I can relax. I can enjoy myself. It'll be a fun month. I don't have to worry because I know I am not going to win." So, and anybody who says to you, "Oh, I voted for you," they're liars. They are liars. Bette Midler is going to win Best Actress. It's not even a debate. So, you know, that's clear. Everything else is up in the air.
Well, what I will tell you is that of the musicals, we have Come From Away, Dear Evan Hansen, Groundhog Day, Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. Here's the thing. Here's what I'm hearing. Not living in New York, having visited recently, but still not living in New York and kind of following it from afar. Dear Evan Hansen, great reviews. Everybody says you got to see it. Groundhog Day, great reviews. Everybody says you got to see it. The Great Comet of 1812, got good reviews, and I don't hear people telling me I have to go see it.
And Come From Away?
I don't hear anything about that at all.
Okay. Well, there you go. That's not quite how I would describe them from being in New York. I've seen every show except for Hello, Dolly. The Bastards didn't give me even a single ticket, so I have no idea about that. But we know.
Oh, wait,
that's
you know
win.
The Bastards, too? I know the Bastards.
Best musical is a tough race. Come From Away is a real audience pleaser. It's just an audience-friendly show. And you have to remember, a lot of the voters for Tonys are producers at out-of-town companies, people that are going to have these shows touring, and they're thinking, what's going to play well with my audience? So you have to remember, when you've got the arty versus the sentimental favorite, that the touring companies and the touring productions are often not always the shows that play well in New York. You know, the ones that are beloved by critics are not necessarily the ones that are going to do great on the road. So in Best Musical, it's a real horse race. Because it got so many nominations, Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 is definitely a factor. It didn't just get all the technical awards we knew it would. It also got Best Actor for Josh Groban, Best Actress for Danae Benton, who is terrific. I'm really glad for her. She's the best thing in the show. And Best Supporting Actor for Lucas Steele, who has this flashy role. So they really like that show. Groundhog Day less so. Come From Away is an ensemble with no names in it. Dear Evan Hansen also got a lot of love. I'm assuming it's down between Dear Evan Hansen and Natasha Pierre, with Come From Away a real threat. That means only one show, Groundhog Day, is probably not going to win. Any one of those others could win. My money's on Dear Evan Hansen.
Well, my money's on Dear Evan Hansen, too, if only because the momentum of the lyricist and music writers of that show, you know, they just did La La Land. They're kind of the it darlings of the moment on Broadway. Absolutely. And in Hollywood.
Absolutely. And the lead actor will probably win Best Actor in a Musical, too, because Ben Pratt is doing a great job. It's a really terrific performance. It's the best thing in the show. His competition is Andy Carl from Groundhog Day, but I think Ben is going to win. Best Play is another big fight. Sweat got the Pulitzer Prize, but it did not get a lot of love from the Tonys. It did get a best play, best director, two supporting actresses, but two other shows did much better, and they are Oslo, which transferred at Lincoln Center, and A Doll's House Part 2 by Lucas Hanath, which, if you recall when we were talking about the Tony season, that was a show I was really excited to see. I decided to invest in it, even though I didn't have a chance in heaven of making my money back. Well, I just saw it two nights ago, and it's absolutely terrific. Oslo is great. A Doll's House is great. They both got so many nominations for acting and in every category that I think those two are going to duke it out. I think Indecent and Sweat are falling by the wayside, but I don't know which one's going to win. Everybody in the cast of A Doll's House got nominated, all four people. But you know what? Three people in Oslo, and that's a big cast of 18. Three of them got nominations, including the two leads, Jefferson Mays and Jennifer Ely. So, you know, either one is a good bet. I'm hoping A Doll's House triumphs, but we'll have to see.
Well, do you think that there's any chance that Josh Groban could win for Comet of 1812?
No, that's going to be Ben Pratt from Dear Evan Hansen. It's the most memorable performance of the year. Ben Pratt just makes the role, makes the show. Christian Borley got nominated for Falsettos. The show that closed got a lot of love from the Tony voters, even though he's now starring in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is a dreadful show that they completely ignored. They also ignored Amelie, with Philippa Sue. They ignored, you know, there was too many shows, but they really did, you know, just completely ignore Amelie, Charlie, A Bronx Tale, which is doing really well, The Play That Goes Wrong, Bandstand. They give a little attention to Anastasia. They nominated the lead actress for the revival of Miss Saigon, which is sort of a fairy tale story. But in a year when you've got 13 musicals opening up, some people are going to fall by the wayside.
Well, explain the fairy tale story aspect of Miss Saigon for just a second.
Oh, well, there's an annual event called the Jimmy Awards that's held in New York City in the summer. I think it takes place in June this year. And kids from high schools all around the country, they have their high school productions of musicals. And judges and people go around to these regions and they look at them and they say, wow, this kid is great. That kid is great. So it's not the show, but the performer. They go to a regional competition and the best of them come to New York. Like 30 kids get to come to New York. They spend a week here and they're rehearsed with top Broadway producers and choreographers. And they create a whole show built around the performances that they had done in their high school. So they do in one night where they do a little snippet from their show, and then they get to a solo number, and then there's a winner. It's a lot of fun, and the level of the quality is really amazing. And 2 or 3 years ago, the lead actress from Miss Saigon was a high school student, just a girl in high school. I mean, she was a kid, and her name is Eva Noblezada, and she made it to New York. Good for her. She made it to New York, and she got like... She didn't even win. I think she got like third place at the Jimmy Awards. But there was a producer in the audience who said, we're doing Miss Saigon in London. Get me that girl. And they took her and they auditioned her. And she went from like the Jimmy Awards to debuting in the West End in a big revival of Miss Saigon.
You know, I knew the answer to that story when I asked it. But I love hearing you explain it. So I wanted our listeners to hear it.
Oh, okay. And so now there she is on Broadway and nominated for Best Actress, and she can relax because she is not going to win. Everybody knows Bette Midler is going to win. You've got Christine Ebersole, a legend. Patti LuPone, a legend. Danae Benton, whose terrific performance in The Great Comet, and Eva Noblezada in Miss Saigon. All four of them can relax because Bette Midler will win for Hello, Dolly.
Well, now, why did you say that The Comet of 1812, and I know I'm shortening the name there, would win all, or at least be nominated in all of the technical categories? What about that show makes it so...
Well, it's a very flashy show. It was staged off Broadway in sort of an environmental space where it was sort of like you were dining at a restaurant and the show took place all around you. They were walking through the tables. They served you caviar and vodka because it was a Russian show about the war and peace. And they're just on the tables, their walkways all through the room. It was just all around you. It was a lot of fun. Then they restaged it in a tent and they did the same thing, but more lavishly. Then they went to Broadway and they ripped out all the seats in the theater. They put this huge staggered stage up. And so there was audience members seated on the stage and tiered behind them. And there's tables and there's a bar and the cast is all over the place. There are ramps going up to the mezzanine. They're dancing down there. There's you know, little crawl spaces and things going in between the rows of the audience all the way to the back of the theater. It's just very much... You walk in, you go, wow, it's lavish, it's exciting, it's fun. It's a really spectacular design. That will win Best Scenic Design unless there is no God. I mean, that's just, it's a given.
But you look at that as a producer in a regional theater and you go, yeah, I can't do that. There's no way I can reproduce
this.
Well,
you can't do it in a, you're absolutely right. You can't do it in a traditional space. But there are more and more untraditional spaces. So, that does create a big challenge, but it also creates a much higher ticket price. You serve people some crappy food and a little shot of vodka, and you get to charge them $130 rather than, you know, $80 or whatever it might be. It does create a lot of dinner pricing possibilities.
Well, now, so, yeah. You know, there was a Sweeney Todd, a revival of Sweeney Todd that was taking place in Greenwich Village, where they actually performed it in a pie shop. And they served, you know, meat pies beforehand. And
they built a pie shop, so it wasn't in a real pie shop. But yeah, they did it in London, did very well. It's still playing here. They just brought in a new cast and all the lead roles. I've had friends who've seen it and said it's really good. The sense of intimacy and menace from having them just right around you. It's really a lot of fun. So if you're in New York, I would check that out.
So at what point do the Tony Awards have like a best cuisine category?
That's coming up soon. I do think that, you know, we've just gotten a new Broadway house. That's where Sunday in the Park with George opened up. That was not eligible for the Tony Awards. They didn't submit it. They didn't want to make, you know, thousands of tickets available to Tony voters because it was a limited run. And that's a beautiful new jewel of a Broadway house. But I think the next Broadway house that gets built, it has to be a non-traditional house without just the boring old stadium seating. It has to be something that they can reconfigure every single time because that's where a lot of shows are going.
Well, okay, I'd get into plays because I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts on Sweat and on Oslo, two plays that I've heard about. Of course, Lynn Nottage winning the Pulitzer for Sweat, and she's kind of a well-known playwright. But look, you know, we could talk all day about the Tony nominations because they're interesting.
That's right. And, you know, while the Tony nominations are happening, two new shows are announced. Michael Moore is coming to Broadway in a one-man show, making fun of Donald Trump, of course. Hopefully it'll be better than the movie that he did. And then there's Warhol Capote, a two-man show based on apparently hundreds of hours of interviews and chats between Andy Warhol and Truman Capote. They decided they were going to make a Broadway play or a musical or something, and they just got together for ages and chatted away, and they found these tapes, and now they've created a show out of that. So you're going to have two actors, one of them playing Andy Warhol, the other one playing Truman Capote. If that isn't Tony bait, I don't know what is.
Well, I guess that'll be for next year, though, correct?
Well, or 2 years from now, who knows when it'll happen?
Well,
they've just been announced. Yeah, they're happening out of town or whatever. Lots of flashy people. And when it happens, it'll be a big deal.
Oh, wait a second. Whenever I hear those two words together, it makes me want to begin our Big Deal or Big Whoop segment. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story was submitted by listener James Gardner. Hollywood took a certain black-humored glee over Sony being hacked. The MPAA didn't even react that forcefully to a foreign government threatening the second biggest export of the American economy, as we mentioned earlier. But now Netflix has been hacked and everyone is a little freaked out. Why? Because it's about to happen to them as well. An online extortionist dubbed the Dark Overlord demanded, or should we say the Dark Overlord,
exactly.
Demanded a payoff from Netflix after it stole a copy of the upcoming season of Orange is the New Black. Before you know it, they had reportedly dumped 10 episodes of the new season online, threatening Netflix's plans to use that popular series to bring in millions of new subscribers. Now, how did the pirates do it? By breaking into one of the many third-party vendors that invariably get handed digital copies of the show at some point during production. And now Variety is reporting that dozens of other TV series may have been accessed by the same pirates. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
What?
Well, why do you think?
Well, I think it's a big deal if only because there is a move in the entertainment industry to move toward an interchangeable media format, so IMF, where all of the assets, audio, picture, for all different types of services, broadcast, streaming, maybe even the DCP for theatrical releases, they're all in one giant file. And then you can, you know, get a copy of that file and pull out of it what you need if you have permission. So, of course, you have to have a key to unlock certain aspects of that file.
And that's in the cloud or?
Well, it's, you know, it's in the
cloud. Or they have to give it to you under secure, yeah.
Well, ideally, it's in a secure cloud that can then be accessed by, you know, known entities. But either way, even if that wasn't happening, the issue with vendors, and most of these vendors are duplication houses and post houses of some sort, they have been leaking for at least 10, if not 15 years. And when relatives.
And that's why I said big whoop, in the sense that this happened before, it's going to happen again. It's a problem, it's an issue, but it's an ongoing one. This is not a new thing.
Yes, but hopefully now somebody takes notice of it, and they have been taking notice of it, don't get me wrong, but now hopefully it will become a bit of an issue so that, you know, something happens with all of these leaks, especially with, you know, DVD duplication in China. It was, you know, basically a license to print, you know, illegal DVDs
well,
and sell them on the street.
Vendors who are ripping you off, as opposed to this, where vendors are being attacked. I know people in the post world and the editing world, and they've been hacked. I've had people I know who have been held hostage had their computers held hostage for this stuff. Say, give us $30,000, or we'll just, you know, they hack into your computer, they take control, and they say, give us $30,000 or whatever. And you know, it's happened. I have other friends who've had attacks at their business, and some of them are dealing with big stars. They have secure rooms in the building. You can't get in without a key. You can't bring in any electronic information. You can't, you know, you can't leave with anything. It's a secure room with a computer that is not connected to the internet. It's right. Just you have to have a safe room to be able to do this stuff. If you're going to deal with video from top, you know, pop stars, or you're going to deal with, you know, films and TV stuff that is incredibly valuable, you have to beef up your security, and everyone has to do it, not just the big studios. It has to be everybody at every, you know, link of the way, because the weakest link is going to be vulnerable.
Well, the bad news for Fox News wasn't so bad when Curiosity brought a solid audience to the first week of Tucker Carlson taking over for Bill O'Reilly. And then they got slapped with another lawsuit. This included charges of widespread racial discrimination, and one of the plaintiffs is currently anchor Kelly Wright. Then Fox News co-president Bill Shine has been forced out and replaced with a woman. Shine is named in multiple lawsuits as playing a key role in defending and shielding both Roger Ailes, the former head of Fox News, and anchor Bill O'Reilly, despite years of sexual harassment charges. So they've gone from hot chocolate to another hot mess. Big deal or big whoop.
And there's another lawsuit. A female host who went public with being infertile for a story in Fox News says that she had approval, she did it, and then 3 days later, they banned her from the air forever. Her name is, she's suing them for gender and disability discrimination. It's Let's Sue Fox News Day. But Suzanne Scott has taken over for Bill Shine. But let's keep in mind, she is a woman, but she was his second in command for the past 20 years. So everything that he did, she was there right by his side.
Right. And, you know, you don't like me using the new word I learned, Michael, but the mm-hmm. optics of this are kind of interesting, because remember, the Murdochs are trying to buy the remaining percentage of Sky over in Europe. And, you right. know, if with all this, discrimination and gender issues, you know, it looks good to have a woman at the top.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what we said weeks ago. The Times, New York Times, did a front page story about the fact, hey, here's one big element to keep in mind. They're trying to buy Sky and get that whole takeover finalized. And we did mention that weeks ago. Hey, you know, this is one thing that's really been something they've been trying to do for a long time now. And they want it to happen, and they're not going to let anything get in their way. So that's why Bill O'Reilly is out. That's why Bill Shine is out. They are cleaning the house because, in part, they really want – it's a changing of the guard. It's new younger people. They think it's disgusting and piggish, but also it's good for business. Well, and speaking of business, Tucker Carlson already has a book deal being pitched around, and people are talking about Bill O'Reilly, after 6 months or a year, coming back maybe in syndication. Maybe that would be an area where he could do a play that would be less vulnerable to the pressure he faced on Fox News.
Well, now, just to kind of make sure that there's some clarification here, by do a play, you don't mean a play that could be nominated for a Tony.
No, I do not.
Right. Now, speaking of plays, fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride in the West End, where Cate Blanchett is planning to star in a stage adaptation of the classic movie All About Eve. Blanchett will star in the role made famous by Betty Davis, a character who is at the peak of fame but sees the young upstart Eve pretending to be a devoted fan but ready to stab her in the back for a shot at glory. As if that's not enough, the play will be directed by hotshot Ivan Vanhove, who currently has Jude Law in London starring in a homoerotic spin on The Postman Always Rings Twice. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. Actor gets role. But Cate Blanchett did just get a Tony nomination for her role in The Present, a Chekhov play. That was her Broadway debut, much anticipated since she's been a great theater person. But I was just noticing, you know, she really is finding all the satisfying roles and fulfilling things in her life on stage in Australia, in London, here in New York. Movies are not as interesting at a certain point, are they?
Especially when they're asking you once again to come to your costume fitting for tights and a cape. In any case, another round of layoffs at ESPN, which grossed more than $2 billion last year, but still wants to tighten its belt. Now, that means that on-air talent, not just any on-air talent, are going to go. This time around, it was clear that former players and coaches are valued, while actual reporters, journalists, and analysts, you know, anyone who's not a jock and might have a more dispassionate take on the game, they're not safe. More than 100 staffers and counting have been cut. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I mean, it's more jobs being gone for actual journalists and people to cover the game with, you know, sobriety and a serious perspective. It's a real shame that the only people they find value in are the big names who came from the game itself.
Are you trying to say that all the big name anchors and on-air talent at ESPN are covering the sports they're covering drunk?
No, not drunk.
You said sobriety, so I'm just saying. In any case, you say here $2 billion last year that ESPN earned. And, of course, we covered last week or the week before the whole ESPN story that was in Bloomberg that had an $11 billion figure. It would be nice to know how much revenue is coming in and being kept by Disney.
Well, the revenue is in the tens of billions of dollars. You've got like $7 billion in revenue from subscribers just for that $7 a month fee that they get. Then they get another almost $2 billion in advertising. So they're getting revenue of about $9 billion, but I believe it's their profits that is over $2 billion a year.
Okay, so when you say gross, you mean earned. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, it probably happened just under the wire, but Daytime Emmy Awards made history last week. Along with awards for The Usual Suspects like General Hospital and Jeopardy, they gave a lead actor in a soap award to Scott Clifton of The Bold and the Beautiful. That made Clifton the first person to win Daytime Emmys for Young Actor, Supporting Actor, and Lead Actor. Just as the genre seems ready to fade into the sunset and yet remains stubbornly viable, Clifton shows you can build an entire career on soap operas. Big deal or big whoop?
That's just kind of cool to see him growing up in the industry like that and do that. And I can't believe it's never happened before, but it's hard because you get lured away or it's just hard to make that transition. So, or you make a leap to leading role right away. So it's just very fun to see. But yeah, you know, Jeopardy won a Daytime Emmy Award. And of course, Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune just renewed for another couple seasons. I mean, they are not going anywhere.
The Gong Show won't be eligible for a Daytime Emmy because, unlike the syndicated original, it's set for prime time. The reboot of the once reviled, now beloved talent show travesty dubbed The Gong Show has found its host and its second-tier British comic, Tommy Maitland.
What? Oh my God. He hasn't been funny since, like, the third Carry On film.
Well, anyway, you may not have heard of Tommy Maitland, but then most Americans hadn't heard of James Corden, and he's done great in Late Night. The only difference is that Tommy Maitland doesn't exist, so I don't know what you're talking about, Michael. He's a character made up by Mike Myers, who decided it would be groovy to create this persona and do the whole thing in character. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't know why, but I love this. It's like Mike Myers is so crazy. He's like the Warren Beatty of comics. You know, he takes 10 years to do anything, and then it's the love guru. Yeah, I've never really liked most of his movies. I mean, the Austin Powers are sort of amusing, but obviously the first one, that's about it. But I don't know. This whole thing, I love it. He did an interview in character. He's got the makeup. He's got a whole back history. It's just, I'm going to watch it just to see what he does with this thing.
Yeah, baby.
Exactly.
You know, what's funny is interesting is I remember reading the first Austin Powers script in like 1995, 96. It was floating around somewhere, one of the agencies I was working on, and everybody was reading it and going, how is this funny? Like, some of it is funny, but, you know, really? But then, of course, you had to see it. It was Mike Myers doing it that made it funny. So, okay, Sony Music is sort of winding down its deal with Dr. Luke, the mega-successful producer whom artist Kesha has accused of sexual harassment and abuse. Apparently, if you, by the way, a little aside, if you're accused of this, it's not good for business. All the bills, and now Dr. Luke. Luke is no longer the CEO of the label he founded, and the page on Sony's website touting their work with him has disappeared. On the other hand, Luke has continued to do work with his production team, but they might not be getting official credit on songs to keep artists who use his work from getting any heat. On the other hand, the trial between Kesha and Luke is going forward. No settling there. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's confusing. I mean, you know, they're trying to break with him, but they don't want to make a big deal about it. And maybe he's been doing work all this time, but they're just doing it on the sly so artists don't get any heat for using him. That's kind of interesting. It's just, who knows what's going on here? It just sounds like, maybe other artists had pushback or why they would make this decision and do it in this way. at this stage, you know, if you wanted to break with him and say, we're standing with Kesha, or we're standing against sexual harassment, if that's what you thought it was, you think they'd do it in a more public, symbolic way?
China, China, China. Or, as the leader of the United States says, China, China, China. Everyone wants a piece of one of the biggest markets in the world, especially when it's still growing bigger. NBC is licensing a local version of Saturday Night Live, though it's safe to expect a lot more music and silly comedy and a lot less political satire. You won't see someone mocking the Communist Party and government corruption each week, though if you did, that would be awesome, even though they wouldn't be invited back next week. Meanwhile, Netflix took a page out of Hollywood's playbook. It partnered with a Chinese company to get Netflix into that country's market via, and I don't know whether you pronounce this or you spell it out, so I'll spell
it out.
IQIYI. Okay, that's the name of the company, or I don't know. That company will bring Netflix original programming like Orange is the New Black to Chinese audiences. And oh, by the way, that's called a distribution deal. Big deal or big whoop?
It's you know, it's more people getting their fingers into China. The more exchange, better, good. As long as you don't compromise your business and your ethics, terrific.
Well, and you could have said years ago, well, you know, Netflix has cracked the French market because they sold, House of Cards to a French distributor.
It wasn't as big as it initially sounded. They said that was they cracked the Chinese market. Well, no, they just sold some shows.
Yeah.
But, you know, China's a big market and Western Europe is a big market. There's a report that they're about to hit 100 million paid TV subscribers this year. In a few weeks, they will probably hit that mark. So cord cutting isn't happening so fast in Western Europe either.
Well, and how many pay cable providers do they have per market? Probably.
They've got a lot more competition, right?
Right. Probably more than one, right? So that actually.
Right. So they're having better service for a better price with better high speed internet.
Yeah. Why, take note, FCC. Tonight on Primetime, Roseanne, then I'm going to watch a little Will and Grace, then some X-Files, and a new Twin Peaks at 10. Wait, have we turned the channel to TV land or maybe back to the late 80s, early 90s? Nope. Those are all TV shows that are coming back to TV. Roseanne is the latest with Barr shopping an eight episode run. Yes, John Goodman and Sarah Gilbert are on board as well. At this stage, about the only TV hit that won't get revived is The Cosby Show. Big deal or big one?
Bump.
Hey, man, you wrote it.
I wanted a ring shot there. It's a big whoop, right? My gosh, you know, it's just every show. Is it a paucity of ideas? I guess.
You know, it's funny because literally as I read this yesterday and you said John Goodman and Sarah Gilbert, I was like, what, wasn't Laurie Metcalf in that show? And then you've written note, not Laurie Metcalf, question mark?
Well, she's on Broadway in A Doll's House Part 2 and nominated for Best Actress in a Play, and damned, I think she'll win it.
Well,
she's absolutely great.
I've seen her in a number of plays and she's quite good.
Oh, she's a terrific actress, yeah.
The TNT series The Last Ship was renewed for 2 seasons with both 10-episode runs shooting all at once. But after a 2-week break, the production is staying on break for a few more weeks while star Eric Dane deals with personal issues. The one-time star of Grey's Anatomy, dubbed McSteamy, that was kind of my nickname in college, actually, Dane went public with that go-to malady, an addiction to painkillers. This time, he's going public about something less common, battling depression. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. That whenever somebody has any drug issue or alcoholism issue, they just say, oh, he's addicted to prescription painkillers. That's what they always say. It's sort of like a ba-dum bump. You know, that's what you say, no matter what it is. But at least they're being public with the fact that they're dealing with some addiction issue. That's good. People talk a lot less about depression, and that can be debilitating too. So I thought it was pretty remarkable and great that they decided to be public about it. I don't know why they did, whether it was a proactive choice or whether somebody was going to publish something or what, but whatever the reason, good for him. And I hope he can get stable and solid and get back to work and take things at the right pace so that he can be acting for many years to come. But I think for Hollywood in general and people in general, being public about depression really helps because a lot of people deal with it in a lot of jobs. And they're afraid to talk about it because it's not like saying, I have cancer or I have this diabetes. Or it's like it's a chronic issue. You have to deal with it all your life. It's no more or less embarrassing than any other medical issue. And that's exactly what it is. And you should be public about it. So good for him.
And Kelly Ripa's new co-host is... not me. I was hoping to get the gig, but apparently I'm stuck with Michael for the foreseeable future.
Hey!
Thanks! Ripa's new co-host is actually Ryan Seacrest because, he's really searching for work, You know?
Well, he was actually.
Yeah, well, it's a big change for Seacrest, who has a daily show on iHeartRadio as well as his weekly Top 40 Countdown. Seacrest is moving to New York City and bringing both shows with him. Indeed, Ripa is building an iHeartRadio studio for him in their building so he can record it right there.
I like to picture her actually hammering and nailing the studio together.
I also love the fact that there's like a big giant deadbolt on it and a lock so that he can't run away like some of the last hosts. They'll face some interesting competition since it's now official Megyn Kelly will be taking over the 9 a.m. hour of the Today Show. Her first big get? The Kardashians' second interview since being robbed at gunpoint. Big deal or big whoop.
Lame.
Yeah, I'm like, wait, didn't that happen like a year and a half ago at this point? That's they've only done two interviews? Maybe nobody wants to talk to them. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. You joke that Ryan Seacrest is busy, but he's actually not. As far as, you know, visible platforms, I mean, he's got a four-hour daily radio show or 3 hours or whatever it is. And that obviously reaches a big audience and American Top 40 Countdown. So that's awesome. But as far as that visible platform, like, you know, nothing can match American Idol in its peak. But he doesn't have a big platform. He's here. He's there. He's doing the New Year's Eve. He's doing this and that. But a regular, steady presence. He really needed this, and this is a really good move for him. He might have been on Good Morning America or Today. You know, he's been on those shows as a person that might have been – he's been at the Olympics. This is a really big platform for him, and it's a big change. He's moving to New York. He's bringing a show with him. It means if there's any future plans for American Idol, they won't include him unless they move to New York as well, because you couldn't possibly do both. So, and it does give him a very valuable daily presence in people's lives that he lacks in the television element. So I think it's a really smart move for him. She was in charge. She's the one who made this decision. Fred Savage and Jerry O'Connell were in the running, and maybe the ABC was sort of leaning towards them because they're cheaper
right.
than Ryan. This was not a cheap get, Ryan Seacrest. But I think it's a good choice for both of them.
Well, Fred Savage is kind of a well-known television director these days. He gets paid a lot of money to direct, both one-camera sitcoms and another fare. And so he's, you know, he doesn't need the gig. Jerry O'Connell also has a nice little career. By the way, went to school with Jerry O'Connell at NYU, and he lives around the corner from me. So I don't know how he would do that show from Los Angeles.
He wouldn't. He'd have to move to New York.
Exactly. They were both very good when they subbed.
Yeah, no, she says they're all friends of the family. But, you know, she does not want somebody else using this as a stepping stone. And Ryan Seacrest is going to be there for 10 years. You know, he's not going anywhere. So that's a real long-term commitment, I'm sure. It's a great platform. It's been a very successful show for a long time. And I bet the two of them will be there for, you know, 2027.
Wow, you're already planning that far out? Okay.
Yep.
All right, well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And
Strike.
Well, here's
strike,
the thing.
Strike.
It's, you know, it would have affected you because you wouldn't have had anything to watch.
Strike.
But here's the thing, Michael, before you
can strike. Strike. Yeah.
Put your signs away because a strike has been averted. The WGA, what? The Writers Guild of America, has reached an agreement for a 3-year contract with studios, networks, and producers.
So all the spam that I stockpiled is not necessary?
No. And, you know, the bunker that you built, mm-hmm. I think maybe you should give it over to Ryan Seacrest. You can do a show from there.
Or Andrew Jackson. He's about to re-wage the Civil War, even though he died before it began. But anyway. Dear God. I wish we'd had a show yesterday because when we started to hear about details about where each side was and what their difference were on the issues, I had notes here saying, you know, I feel like they're close enough that they could make a deal. I feel like they should be able to make a deal. I know 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we said, it looks like a strike. You know, the writers were very serious. They're like, we will strike. And that's one reason why you think they actually worked this time, didn't you?
Yeah, because previously the writers for like a year were threatening, you know, we're going to go on strike next year if you can't like come to the bargaining table with something, you know, to offer. And the studios went, okay, well, we'll take that into consideration when we sit down to negotiate, which won't be this year. And instead, they went out and they made a whole bunch of movies and they made a whole bunch of television to hold themselves over in case there was a strike. Well, this time around, the writers got smart and they said, yeah, yeah, we'll negotiate closer to the deadline. It should take like a week, maybe two, to settle everything up. And
so you think they were playing them?
Oh, no, I don't know whether they were or weren't. But if they were, boy, that was smart of them, because the last time they signaled very early on that this was going to be difficult. And the studios took them seriously and made a whole bunch of content that they could release over the course of a year.
By planning for a strike and planning to stockpile stuff. But even despite the stockpiling, it still hurt them badly.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you know, the number of radio shows and television news shows in Los Angeles talking about how much money was lost during the 100-day writer's strike the last time around, which was about 10 years ago, it was like $200 million a week was being lost.
Well, that's what they anticipated would happen this time.
Okay.
Based on inflation and where we were now. But the point is, you said last time a strike was more likely because the studios took them seriously and stockpiled shows, but that didn't prevent the economic damage. This time, are you saying if the studios had stockpiled shows, they might have gone on strike and said, fine, we'll go on strike again? Or are you just saying they realize even if you stockpile shows, the breakup in continuity and the business is not really good, and if they're serious about striking, we need to come to a reasonable accommodation?
I think the latter. I'll go with the latter.
Yeah.
I think
my feeling was, we don't have the details yet on a lot of stuff. They're still working some things out. We'll probably be talking about them next week. My tip, if we had a show yesterday, was the writer should walk into the room and just put up posters on the wall listing the salaries of all the heads of all the major corporations. Time Warner's Jeff Bukes, $32 million. Disney's Bob Iger, $43 million. NBC Universal's Steve Burke, $46 million. AMC's Josh Sapin, $30 million in the year his stock fell 30%. AMC's COO, Ed Carroll, $22 million. It's like, you know, yeah. And you said they should just post the net profits that they all have.
Right.
So you know what? We're asking for a piece of the pie. And you broke the numbers down, right? The writers say maybe it's $150 million over the 3 years. That's what they're talking about and what they gained?
Well, on their website, they said over the course of 3 years, it could amount to $130 million or more in gains. Okay. Right. And
this is a three-year deal.
Right. And we're talking about companies that make, okay, not just, you know, their earnings are billions of dollars. Yes, they make even more revenue, but they actually take home and give to investors billions of dollars. They cry poor all the time. Don't get me wrong. They're always crying poor. Networks, record labels, which, by the way, the record labels, they might actually be poor these days. But studios and networks are always crying poor, no matter whether they are flush or not. And to say over 3 years, you're giving the people who help create your content $130 million extra. And I understand, I get the fact that if you give something to the writers, the directors are going to come along and the actors are going to come along. And then, you know,
the union people, the drivers, the set designers, the costumers, there's a lot of people right. $130 million to one guild means $1 billion. But you know what? You're talking five major studios, are there?
I think there's six major studios. Yes.
Six major studios, 3 years. That's about, you know, $25 million each. Let's say $30 million, which would get you to $180 million that they'd be paying out to the writers.
Right.
Say there's 10 guilds. That's $300 million a year.
Well, I mean, look, at this point, we're just kind of like throwing numbers around. Because
I'm just saying, but the numbers are so low compared to, you know, the profits. That I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, the idea that you almost struck and you're like, well, fine, we'll give you another $40 million a year. You know, it just seems, you know, to the thousands of the 12,000 people that they represent, you know, spreading that amount. You know, it's not like they're getting $40 million to a person. They're getting, you know, it's like how many people in the Writers Guild? Like 12,000?
6,000.
Yeah, 12,000 full members of WGA East and West and another 12,000 part-time members or, you know, not fully vested members.
That sounds like an awful lot, but okay.
That's according to what I looked up on the, I think it was Wikipedia.
Which we know is always correct.
Wikipedia is actually very accurate.
I know.
It's more accurate than your typical encyclopedia from back in the day.
But it's so much fun to make, to you know, rib them a little bit.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, I mean, these are pretty small numbers as far as, you know, should we say, they didn't gain that much?
Well,
that
here's
may be the
thing.
Other way of looking at it.
Their pension and their health plan was severely underfunded and it needed to be rescued. So the studio said, all right, we're going to rescue that, but we want you to kind of, you have this nice Cadillac plan. We need you to start cutting costs there because we're not paying for that again. We'll rescue this time, but it ain't happening again. So,
and what's your health plan? That's what I'd like to know.
Oh, it's not a Cadillac. No, it's a Bentley, actually. They have the Bentley plant.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was that parody. So it looks like the streaming shows and some of the cable networks will begin to, the pay for those shows will rise. Okay, so no word on how much or whether it will reach parity with broadcast networks. No word
and
on that
span,
yet.
And the whole issue of holds on writers and what's a, you know, a short run series versus a long run series and cable versus primetime. There's a whole lot of issues that we have don't have information on yet.
Right, and it used to be, you know, you were working on a TV show, you were on hold, you know, if you were one of the on staff, it was all 22 episodes. Well, right now you're down to 11 or 10 sometimes, maybe 13 episodes, but you're still on hold for all as if it was all 22. Not to mention the fact that when you shoot one of these things, it used to be a week, 8 days for an hour long drama, maybe 8 days for a one camera shoot like a Modern Family. Now it's taking 3 weeks sometimes for some of these shows to shoot, and you're basically paying either the same or less, usually less, to the writer and asking them to work longer and more. So they, you know, the guild said, look, we got to come to some terms on that. And it looks like they reached terms on healthcare, reached terms on parity, reached terms on residuals, and reached terms on what is called, as you mentioned, span.
All right. So we'll have the details later and we'll be looking into them.
Well, that is true. We hope so. Yes.
So the strike is dead, and of course, Jonathan Demme is dead, one of Hollywood's major directors, one of the biggest Oscar wins of all time. He died at 73 of cancer. He was pretty upfront about having cancer a few years ago and that it was a serious one. And his obviously the first thing that people mention is The Silence of the Lambs, the first horror or thriller film to win Best Picture, arguably. It was the third film in history to sweep the top five awards, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Actor, and Best Actress. Only two other movies have ever done that. It Happened One Night and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I was going to make a joke about What Happened One Night, but...
you know, a lot of love and affection for Jonathan Demme. It's his quirky early movies that I love. And it's sad, you know, you look at him winning the Best Picture and he seemed to lose interest or lose creative mojo or something, but it was all downhill after Silence of the Lambs, I'll tell you that. A lot of not very interesting movies.
Yes, Something Wild. Yes, these were the early quirky movies were Something Wild and Stop Making Sense was a documentary about the Talking Heads. But then you're right, it did kind of, you know, his
yeah,
later years.
Philadelphia, which also was lauded and important, but was, you know, Oscar bait and has not held up. And a remake of The Manchurian Candidate, a remake of Charade, as if that needed to be remade. It was just like he'd lost complete interest. Who knows how it happens, but he had a good run. Something Wild is sweet. Swimming to Cambodia is a fun film with Spalding Gray. And Stop Making Sense, I think, is probably his greatest film. I mean, it's one of the great concert films of all time. Top two or three for sure, right along with The Last Waltz and whatever else your other favorite pick is. So really cool movies. And, you know, I followed in his footsteps.
What?
Well, he went to the University of Florida and he was their first film critic. He walked in and said, hey, you guys don't have a film critic. I'm going to be your film critic. And they were like, okay. And that's how he became the film critic at the Independent Florida Alligator. And that's a job that I took over when I was there. I always was looking forward to interviewing him and mentioning that, but it never happened.
Now, did you take it over from him?
No, he had left school quite a while earlier.
Okay. Just checking.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was reviewing his movies when I was there.
Okay. Yeah, that's
I'm not
true,
that
actually.
Old. He's 73. and by the way, it's my birthday. Speaking of how old I am.
That's true. I was saving it to the end.
I didn't know you knew. This is what drove me nuts though. Rolling Stone had a link celebrating Jonathan Demme, and their story was the 20 essential Jonathan Demme movies.
There's only 20 to begin with.
20. Yeah, he has more when you count documentaries. He didn't even make 20 feature films. It is so insulting and just naming every movie he ever made. It's just ridiculous. It's just, I don't know why they're not humiliated when they do crap like that. It's just absurd. You know, because he definitely has 3 or 4 really great movies that are well worth seeking out. Talking about his 20 essential films is just absurd.
Well, as we're saying goodbye to Jonathan Demme, every week we say hello to our listeners. And you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And Andrew Einsbrook wrote to us. He's from Wild Pure Heart Productions from Australia. And he wrote, hello, Sperling and Michael. I'm an episode or two behind, but thought I'd make sure this came to your attention, and it's a story about the makers of Spinal Tap suing the studio. It's interesting.
Did we not cover that? I know I had it in the notes at one point. Maybe we cut it or didn't get to it.
Well, I moved it down here because I knew Andrew had...
No, a story we'd done weeks ago about this.
Oh, maybe we did. I mean, yeah. There's so many stories, I've lost all count.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly was in there. I don't know if we, for some reason, cut it, but I know we had it on there to talk about.
Well, Andrew writes, it's interesting to me how every now and then someone tries to take on the system. These guys seem like they stand as good a chance as any to find redress. Still loving the show after all these years and continue to be amused that Karen's photo and bio are still in the sidebar and above Michael's. Cough, Squarespace, cough. I think what Andrew is saying is if we had Squarespace, I'd actually know how to remove Karen's photo. you guys rock. Talk soon, Andrew Einsbrook.
Well, thanks for writing in. Yeah, that case, I think we've mentioned it on the show, but it is fascinating. They have deep pockets. They're suing over contractual issues. The studios claim that this movie, Spinal Tap, has never made any money. Is absurd, and we'll have to see where it ends up. It's one of those cases where they may get their money, but it won't be wildly important unless they get to trial and we can dig up dirt and set some standard for everybody else that comes after them.
Well, that's actually what makes this story important, is because it's being brought by Harry Shearer, and then all of a sudden Rob Reiner and some of the other creators. All the other talents said, okay, fine, we'll sign on too, and kind of make this a mini class action, if you will. And I guess they all said, look, we've earned $900, something ridiculously low for like 25, 30 years. This is obviously not correct. And so we're going to the studio and asking them to either pay up, or if they're not going to and claim that it still hasn't made any money, fine, we'll take you to court and you can bring your books with you when the trial starts. And of course, everybody always knows, and we've said this here countless times, Michael, that when lawsuits like this are filed, they're filed for a really high amount so that you settle much lower, and they always settle because the studios never want to go to court, right? Because then all of their accounting practices will be laid bare. Right. And here's the thing. Harry Shearer has no interest in settling. None of these people have any interest in settling because they don't really care about the money. It's not about the money to them. It's about the fact that the studio...
They're being insulted.
Right, exactly. That it's like they're being told, oh, it hasn't made any money. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. We both know that. We're not going to give it to you, but we both know. No, this time they're saying, yeah, that's fine. We might know, but we're going to find out for sure because we're going to trial. Let's go.
But it's very hard to go to trial if they say, we're handing you this money.
Well, that's the thing. That's what this story in Bloomberg is pointing out, is that, you know what? Maybe this is the one, much like Art Buchwald was with Coming to America, where he didn't care. He just wanted to go to trial and have it all laid out in public. Same thing. And it happens once a generation. This might be the case that goes all the way to court.
Right. I'm just saying that the studio offers up a lot of money, but they can always say, hey, look, until the books are open and we look at them, we won't know whether you're paying us the right amount. So we want to go to trial.
Right.
All right. Well, we've got another email. This one is from Lawrence Kaufman.
Yes, and he writes in, he says, regarding Showbiz Sandbox episode number 362 and the Fate of the Furious performance overseas, not mentioned was that it played in 3D in many foreign markets, but only in 2D in the United States. I know it played in IMAX and Real D3D in China and Australia and probably most other markets. And then Lawrence has a whole list of countries and what the film made in each of those countries. But one country in particular caught my eye because I have a little bit of a read into it, and that is Brazil, where it made $12.8 million on its opening weekend.
And it's fascinating because we know that 3D is still a big player for movies overseas. And like he says, I wasn't even thinking, oh, this movie might have been a 3D movie in the rest of the world. It wasn't even 3D at all here in the U.S., but it did in fact play in 3D and people are still excited by it. So how did it do? What sort of breakdown do we have?
Well, okay, we're up to, here's the breakdown, April 23rd, which is the second week that the film was in theaters. That week, it had a 50.6% market share in Brazil.
Okay. You're going to get numbers crazy. We don't care about its market share.
Okay, here's the thing. Fast and Furious 8, or Fate of the Furious, whatever it's called, $26 million, I'm doing this in dollars rather than reais, $26.2 million total cum gross to date.
In Brazil, it's grossed $26 million.
By
in 2D, that $6 million.
That's right.
In 3D, it's $18 million. In 4D, why in God's name do they have 4D? That's less than $1 million. And in IMAX, it's just a couple hundred thousand dollars. So they made most of their money in 3D with a little bit extra from 4D and IMAX. That gets you up to about $20 million. So they made more than three times as much in 3D as they did in 2D. Not only are people going to see the movie in 3D, it's not just an opening weekend phenomenon, as I might have pointed out, North America, but they're making like 68% of all their money from 3D and beyond, if we want to call it that. So 2D is by far less preferred, even after the second weekend at the cumulative grosses. So tons of people went to see this movie. Most of them saw it in 3D or 4D or IMAX, and 2D was by far way, way back in the pack.
And I'm surprised you didn't mention the average ticket price here. It's kind of an interesting. Okay. It's $5.47 is the average ticket price. And I remember at Expo Cine last year in November, there was a complaint about how high ticket prices have gotten. Some tickets cost 14 reais, which is, it's 3 reais to the dollar, roughly.
But what's the annual income, or what's the average household income? Well, that may be a ton of money.
Yeah, it's not what it is in the U.S., but, even 3D tickets cost $6 instead of the $5.47.
Well, that's the average, but what you don't have is an average ticket price for 2D.
Right.
That's the only
yes,
one you're
correct.
Missing. So I'd like to know if the $6 is 3D, $8.60 is 4D, $8.40 is IMAX. We'd have to figure out. It's not that much, probably like $5 for 2D, which again tells you that's a 20% increase to get up to 3D's prices of $6. But that's, in North Americaners, that sounds really close, almost as if you're paying practically the same amount. So why not take 3D? So when given the chance and it's only a little bit more expensive, they do it. When it's 30% more, which is what it is in the U.S. often, then you're talking about a real ticket shock.
Well, and, here's the thing. And I realized that, the Fate of the Furious, this is a 4D, It's a wet dream for 4D companies because, of course, it's in a car, you're driving.
All vibration. Yeah.
It was only on 6 screens, and yet it accounted for 3% of the box office.
Well, how many screens are there total? Probably not that many.
How many screens are there showing the film? Or
in 4D.
Oh, I don't know. Probably not that many. Probably under 30.
So it was a huge movie, and people are going to see it in 3D, and that's happening not just in Brazil, but all over the world.
And as Patrick Von Sikowski, my counterpart over at Celluloid Junkie, pointed out, he said, look, what you really have to do is go back and look at Fast and the Furious 7, look at some other movies that in Brazil and see how they did to see if this is an anomaly, this particular film, or whether this is truly the trend.
Well, and whatever it is, I think worldwide, we imagine we will see what we saw in North America. People were excited by it for a while, and then they got bored.
Well, and the reason it wasn't showing in 3D in North America, in part, is because in North America, the distributor pays for the glasses, the 3D glasses, whereas in other parts of the world, that is not the case.
Who pays for them?
Either the exhibitor, the movie theater owner, or the customer themselves. So it's a $4 million charge in the U.S., and they just said, well, we don't care. We're not going to show it in 3D.
Right, and it's not a family film, so that might be another reason why it's more likely to have drawn people willing to watch it in 3D.
Correct.
Kids hate 3D glasses, and that's not an issue here as much.
Correct.
All right.
But certainly,
well, thanks for pointing us out to keep an eye on 3D grosses, of course, worldwide.
Yes, and both Lawrence and Andrew wrote to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They could have called and left us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is our email address. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to contact us and ways to subscribe to us. You can subscribe to our show and never miss an episode. You can subscribe in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe, rate, and review the show. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website as well, showbizsandbox.com. It's also where you'll find ways to follow us. Our Twitter handle is @showbizsandbox. You can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up, and you can contact us through our Facebook page as well. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, who is mgmt.com. And Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's willworkforbettemidlertickets.com.
Well, maybe they would give them to you for your birthday. Congratulations on turning 21 again.
No, I'm not ashamed. I'm 51 years old. Very exciting.
Oh my gosh, you're over the hill, down the other side, and right up the other mountain.
I got an email wishing me a happy birthday from the AARP. That means you're old.
Or they've gotten your email address wrong.
Exactly. So yeah, so very exciting. Who knew? I just saw this today for the first time. The Battle of Hogwarts took place on May 2nd in 1998. That ended the second Wizarding Wars in the Harry Potter books. But more interestingly, the King James Bible was first published on May 2nd in the UK, way back when. So me and the Bible got a birthday in common.
I think one might be a little older than the other.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work on whatever website it is he mentioned, why not head on over to the Huffington Post to find some of his coverage of the entertainment industry? Or, you know, you can always find it on michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, do not forget to check out bookfilter.com for the latest and what to read. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.